today I want to talk about one of academia's biggest blind spots. It's not the only one. And actually, some of you who know open source will recognize maybe this is a riff on a title from some work that was done a few years ago. Yeah, I work at a place called Space Telescope Science Institute. We were set up in the early 80s to run the Hubble Space Telescope, which we still do today, and we're currently preparing the ground system for the James Webb Space Telescope, which is the next major NASA mission. And my role there is to run the data management operations and think about the tools and services that we build for the community. So the riff is on this blog post, which was written by a lady called Nadia Iqbal, who works at GitHub these days. And she was doing some research on open source, and it was funded by the Ford Foundation. And this was the output of that. It's an interesting report. It's pretty easy to find. And the idea is that there is sort of unseen work going on in open source, and that there's these sort of foundational pieces in open source technology that are unfunded generally, and it's an unseen kind of aspect of the digital infrastructure that lots of technology companies rely upon. And she was actually writing this for Roll prior to being funded to do this research. She was actually a VC funder in Silicon Valley, and she was realizing that lots of the people that were coming and presenting ideas to her were just kind of assuming that they could make use of all this open source technology out there. And she kind of dug into the sort of core infrastructure that is open source. So, and she wrote this blog post, VC's The Internet's Biggest Blind Spot. And so I want to talk about one of academia's biggest blind spots today. I want to talk about software, and I want to talk about software being developed in academic environments and its status. And honestly, I think a lot of what I could talk about today could be said of data products that people produce, high-value shared data sets that get reused by lots of different communities. But software is what I know most about and what I'm going to spend time talking about today. So I think the first thing to kind of say is that software is important. And this is not a statement without evidence. If you go and survey a bunch of scientists, this happened last time I know about this was in about 2009. More than 2,000 scientists were asked about the role of software in their research. Upwards of 90% of them reported that software is either important or very important to their work, to their research. It's also everywhere. This is sort of whether you're sort of a fan of the Marc Andreessen software is eating the world narrative. We know that both in industry and in academia that software is becoming a core part of every industry. And so my favorite example is John Deere, because I think their tractors are cool, so does my son. And John Deere consider themselves a software company these days, software that runs on these green things. When you buy a John Deere tractor, you do not buy a copy of the software. You have a license to use the software, but their intellectual property, the core thing that differentiates this harvester from a competitor, is the software system that's controlling that piece of hardware. Also, go and look at the terms of service for Tesla Model 3s. You're not allowed to use them for Uber or Lyft. And you should think about why that might be. There's a terms of service for your car. And so this is a very nice statement. Somebody will know Gail here. He is very, he's at INRA, I think, and he's very heavily involved in the scikit learn and the sort of data science open source tool chain for in Python. And he has a nice kind of summary of the role where software touches the work we do in quantitative predictions, controlling experiments, supporting rejecting theories. And I think for me, certainly in my role, the way we're thinking about kind of future science, software is becoming increasingly important. This is in part due to a sort of a centralization around a relatively small number of major instruments. So this is the large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which I saw in my Twitter feed this morning. They just got the keys to the building in Chile. So the mirror and this telescope is going to be seeing first light in the next couple of years. This is, as long as it makes it through the 2019 budget, this is the next large-scale survey telescope to be put in space. This is a telescope called WFIRST. And The sort of this is a community funded NASA funded project, but where the data will be open for the community at any point to analyze. Or maybe the software is part of you're doing simulations of the universe. The software is a core part of the generation of data and also part of the way that we do our analyses. And I think Victoria Stodden, who's I think at Illinois these days, has a nice kind of phrase here that, one of the things she worries about and I worry about is that deep intellectual contributions are encoded in the software that we write to do and produce our scientific results, but we generally don't see these things out in the literature in the same way as papers. So in my sort of cartoon form, the thing I worry about is that we throw, numbers, data into not a black box here, a gray box, and then we produce results out at the end, and we just share those. Those go through peer review in the form of papers, but we generally don't think about what's going on in the middle. And so here's my XKCD sketch of what I think this could potentially mean, is that as we become more data intensive, as more of the kind of scholarly activity moves into software, which isn't being reviewed and published, then our chance of reproducing any result tends downwards. And I think this is a problem, potentially. So there's lots of good writing and scary writing and about crisis in reproducibility crisis. And I think that's something that generally gets talked about less in subjects like physics, astronomy, and astrophysics, but there's some definitely supporting evidence in terms of the number of retractions over the last decade. Only about a 50% increase in papers, but about a tenfold rise in retractions. And I think one of the things that we can do to help alleviate this is to think about how we can unpack the box, how we can get inside the kind of methods and tools that we're building and applying, and think about how we can start sharing those more as researchers. Now, this is all very well. Here are some reasons you might want to do that. But right now, I think there are very few incentives for the individual researcher to be actually sharing more of their work other than what's generally considered an acceptable looking PDF. And so one thing I think we don't talk about enough, and I kind of, when thinking about open science, I like the previous speaker's kind of comment about like what is it that we're asking people to do. I don't think we talk about enough the sort of competitive advantage of producing good tools and sharing them and accelerating science in our community. We're thinking mostly about the sort of principles of open science. I think we should be thinking about what is it that working in this way can do for you. So I want to give you two examples where software has been a competitive advantage in my career, and then maybe talk about how that can be applied more generally. So after finishing my PhD in astrochemistry, I went and worked at a place called the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. There's some joke here about beautiful buildings and private money, which probably works quite well here. This is the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute in Cambridge. They were one of the centers that sequenced the original human genome. This is roughly a 15-year project. The genome was sequenced. It was some number of billions of dollars. I'm not sure anybody can give you an exact number there. And I joined at a time when they had moved from a sequencer that looked like this and an institute of about 800 people and this many sequences just churning through the original human genome that was being sequenced. They were moving away from this single project, which had a lot of Perl, it turns out, and some C and C++ for aligning genomes. But they were going through a pretty significant change, and that was, this is kind of a graph that maybe some of you have already seen, but what we've got on here is the cost per megabase, and so we've got Moore's Law plotted here on the white line, and you can see, so I joined Sanger kind of here, just when there was a change in sequencing technology, so the cost per megabase of sequencing was absolutely going through the floor, and you can see there's another drop down there, and I should probably update my numbers here, but And the change was kind of an interesting one for me as an astronomer, which was they'd basically changed the way in which they were preparing the DNA and sequencing it. So instead of these very long reads, they'd gone to these very short read sequences where they basically wash these chemicals over these DNA slides, and then the depending on which amino acid is there, they fluoresce. So they take lots of pictures, and they actually weirdly look like kind of crowded interstellar fields to my eyes. There's just lots of, it's a black background with lots of dots on it. And then, depending on, they go through this preparation stage, they basically just kind of chop down the DNA and go through slide by slide by slide. They get lots of pictures, they do this analysis, and they get this sequence. And this was the hardware that was driving that revolution. This is an Illumina sequencer. And for those of you with eagle eyes will notice there is the root username and password stuck to the front of that machine. And so we had one of these machines, and then we had 10, and then we had 30. And you know, it radically changed the way that the Institute behaved. Not even the hardware was stable. First sequences that we received had drill holes in the side because they were overheating. The hardware wasn't even stable. Yeah, presumably. A change was the only constant in this environment. And one of the things that we had to think about was we were now moving from a single project to one where everybody wanted to sequence everything they could find at some level. So we moved from a place of having one project to having thousands of projects. And we ended up building some tools like this one, which is called SequenceScape. And the idea was that people could register. It basically became a place for people to register new projects and have a budget and ask for sequencing internally. This stuff's up on GitHub these days, I believe. But you know, we built a set of tools to support a very different mode of operation of the Institute. Following that, I had a second opportunity at kind of elevating the role of software. So I got involved pretty early in a project called Galaxy Zoo, which was basically a project where a postdoc and a student took, or two postdocs and a student, took about 1 million pictures that looked a little bit like this. This is from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and asked members of the public to say something about their shape. It was pretty simple, say if it's an elliptical galaxy, fuzzy one, if it was a spiral galaxy, which way is it spinning, or whether it was a star or some kind of instrumental artifact. And they built this project. It had about 300,000 people come to this project over about a year, and they knew they wanted to do more. And so we built a whole suite of these projects, which in a project called Zooniverse, and we built a whole basically a very flexible domain model, shared tooling that allowed us to build about 30 projects over 2 years. And so Galaxy Zoo became a project that looked a bit like this. This is probably my favorite project we did, a project called Snapshot Serengeti, where it's literally pictures of animals on the internet, and you get to count what they are and say what they are. And this was camera traps in the Serengeti. And you know, the platform that we built, the shared infrastructure that we built, had become our competitive advantage as a research project. So this project that was using data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter took us about 6 days to build. The original project obviously cost a huge amount more. And so, you know, we had this opportunity to use software as our competitive advantage. But both of these, I think, were special cases. And I think I'll kind of try and give you a summary of why I think they are. You know, the Wellcome Trust is a private charity. It's one of the biggest medical research funders in the world. But it's Henry Wellcome, who is a guy. I think he sold first aid kits in the First World War.
Say again? Charles Wellcome became Big Pharma.
Right. Right. But you know, the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute had thousands of people there, hundreds of people who were in kind of an engineering track, and there was some hope of a sort of career path as an engineer working at a scientific institute. And in truth, Zooniverse was staffed with people who'd pretty much given up on a research career and were very happy just writing code, which in a university, which actually wasn't, you know, you could do a few years without anybody noticing. So if software is becoming increasingly important, one of the things I want to kind of walk you through and think about is what do we have to do? What are the actions that we have to take for these not to be special cases? What do we have to do if we want to enable people to exist in academia who want software to be their contribution or a large part of their contribution to the sort of scholarly output? And Jake Vanderplas, who some of you might know, he's at UW. He's actually 50% employed at Google now, I believe, as well. He has a nice blog post about the kind of risk Jake is an astronomer. He's talking about the risk to astronomy, in particular, that the skills required to be a successful scientific researcher are increasingly indistinguishable from the skills required to be successful in industry. So, you know, the risk is this software isn't creditable as a research output. This is the bus you can take from downtown San Francisco to Mountain View every day to Google and have a very nice job. Okay, so and then another way to think about this, Phil Bourne, is, you know, what is the way, well, we must find a way to legitimize software as a form of scholarship. So I want to talk about why software isn't creditable as a research output. And I think there are a bunch of reasons this could be. And so here's my obligatory side with some source code in the background. It's the only one, I promise. And so there are a collection of, here are just some I can think of. You know, some of these are, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. When you say software as a research output, mm-hmm. what are we researching? It's the language. Is structure, is computer science, is software applied to what the
I mean, when area? Software forms a core part of producing your scientific results, so a calibration pipeline that takes raw data from an instrument to science.
Well, it's a tool.
It's engineer. I would say it was engineering. No, mm-hmm. It's not answering a question about the nature of reality. It's the only question is, can we make this happen? And that's an engineering question. Mm-hmm.
So I certainly wouldn't dispute that there's lots of software that we're like understanding the science and being entangled with it is like a core thing. There's like no doubt that there are mm-hmm. guys who are writing software and they're the chief scientists. But on the other hand, right, you have a whole spectrum that goes all the way to there's people who are digging the LHC pipe or something like this, and they are not the scientists. They are a technician. Mm-hmm. Do you have any principles for distinguishing between the two? Like at what point can't we just say, well, his job is indistinguishable from working at Google because he's basically doing a similar job, and they are hired rather than just like, is it just the fact they have a PhD or?
I think it's people who have a research position who spend a significant fraction of their time producing software and not just writing papers.
But it's like the name of the research position is the way to distinguish it?
I'm not sure it's necessary to distinguish. I'm saying that people who, if I spend a significant fraction of my time building a better tool that then maybe I share with the community and write one less paper, I'm probably less likely to have a good research career as well.
That's right, but maybe those people shouldn't be in research positions. Like, I think in general, I think the case you're describing could definitely happen. The case can also be, I'm a researcher, but I decided
to write software. I mean, he uses Python to do whatever, and that it's part of the research of that whatever. It's not just a hidden tool.
Sure.
I mean, one of the ways that we sort of get around this, right, is, and I think about people who build packages, you know, for, I'm thinking of one which is WordFish, it's a political science tool. Mm-hmm. People write a paper, they obviously they describe the methods, mm-hmm. they apply it to a data set to show that it works,
yep.
publish the paper, there's the code attached, citations come.
Yeah, I'm going to get to that, so yes.
And that's like,
I agree. I'm going to tell you why I think that's not good enough.
Okay.
So yeah.
Yeah. It seems for me that you're considering research only as from the position of a researcher, and it's like to make research happen, we need a whole ecosystem, and even if you're an engineer by formation, and then if you commit to make the research happen, you're part of the research. It's like, you know, I think it's part of the problem, differentiating those positions, that nowadays we don't have any incentives for people to do like large reviews or, you know, because it's not considered to be research work, for example. If I follow your
I mean, we pay people to take care of the building, and they're not researchers, And so instead of trying to pay them with prestige, we pay them with money. And so the question is like, how do you, like, where do you draw the line? And like, I think just being in a research position, if you want to start doing stuff that is traditionally compensated with money, you would just like take a job that's compensated with money rather than one that's compensated with prestige or whatever.
Well, right, converse, if you are a researcher and you need to have software for your research,
yeah,
then you need to be able to pay the people to do it.
I agree.
You need to be able to go enter the NSF and say, I need $500,000.
Totally agree. Totally agree. Yep.
And that's currently not possible. You can get money for big experimental setups, but if you ever theoretically, if you simulate the galaxy or something, then it's very difficult to hire a researcher, sorry, to hire a programmer.
Yeah, so you either need to be able to pay them or give them credit, like in some other form of.
Right, but then so then in certain situations the system might be very different.
Some programs,
yes, we should just be able to have more money for this. We need money for this.
Maybe
so that's, like,
that's not the only solution. I mean,
I'm not saying it's the only solution. I'm just saying that there are cases where that is the solution, and I don't know how to distinguish between the two.
Sure, we should talk about that. Okay, I've realized my font is too big here and stuff's floated over. So some problems with giving credit for software are technical and some are cultural. So how do you cite software in a publication? Some journals, don't allow software citations. Software citations aren't necessarily indexed. So if you wanted to, sorry, that doesn't show up on the one at the bottom there. So even if you did start allowing citation of software, how would you know what kind of impact a piece of software was having in a field? Software isn't generally peer-reviewed, certainly in academia. So having understanding of what the sort of quality of is not clear. And the last one's meant to say, you know, software can't generally be cite other software easily. So I want to talk about some possible solutions to raising the role of software in research. And some of those fall into sort of self-service, individual actions that you can take as an individual researcher. And some are self-service in terms of maybe a sort of a research group or a small number of individuals. And some of them are external and their ecosystem kind of fixes, as I would describe. So first one I want to talk about is writing a software paper. So this is generally considered a good fix because it's something you can do yourself. So you can some journals allow you to write a paper to a journal that describes some results, and you sort of attach a piece of software to it, and then we have something for people to cite. And so, okay, so this is good because it doesn't require us to change anything with the kind of current way of publishing research outputs. But, you know, if I've gone to extra effort to produce a piece of software, most journals now would expect me to have a science paper that connects the software, not just a paper just about the software. So I have to both write software and produce some novel results to go with that. And not all journals accept papers that are explicitly about software. And then there's this sort of problem about authorship. If I have a very successful piece of software and it's long-lived, well, the authors for the original package probably changed between versions 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever versions you have. And so maybe you want to write many papers about this piece of software because you want to give credit to the new authors. And now you have problems because you've got citation dilution. You've got, you know, it's a poor fix in the long term, I think, for the most successful, long-lived pieces of software. So what about going beyond the software paper? So another kind of maybe obvious way to fix this is make it possible to directly cite software in the literature. So, you know, this is harder because I think it's an ecosystem fix. This is work now is required by publishers. And I think it's actually just worth talking about, like, what do we actually mean by citation? Like, what's the purpose of citation? If you Google this, here are some answers you can get to that question. But I think we have in our minds, Jeffrey Builder, a guy who is the CTO of an organization called Crossref, which is a pretty important part of the scholarly infrastructure. They assign a lot of DOIs for the literature. He has this idea of academia has a citation fetish. We directly equate citation with credit. And that's only one of the reasons that you cite to give credit. There are other good reasons. And so I kind of don't want to trying to further that too much by saying that if software citation were possible, then people who wrote research software would get more credit, but it is one of the effects. So what would a software citation look like? Well, maybe it would look something like this. It would be my name, the title, maybe the release, maybe where the software is, I don't know. Or maybe actually is this good enough as a software citation? Can I just name the package? Can I just talk about where the software lives? But imagine we can do it. Imagine we can make it possible to cite software. Then we'd be in a good place. But again, it's an ecosystem fix, so maybe only some of your journals would allow you to do it. Also, believe it or not, some journals have citation limits. Yeah, have a fixed number of citations, which seems kind of strange, especially in a digital age. And we rely on indexes generally to count the things that we cite, and that's not generally something that we're in control of. And so, you know, if we can't count it and we can't build kind of impact metrics around it, then we don't have anything necessarily to show and help people with their career path. So there's actually work going on in this space. So I'm involved in an organization called Force 11, which some of you may know about. It's a conference about research communications. And so they have this model of getting together groups of people who want to work on a shared problem. So we were working on software citation as a topic area that we wanted to kind of get the community thinking about. And you can find the outputs of that work here. My problem with most of this is I think that, you know, we're trying to force, I'm trying to force kind of software into an ecosystem that's built around papers and paper citations and a system that I would argue works pretty well for what it's designed for. And I'm kind of giving you answers to this where we're trying to sort of force software into the mix. I really like this picture, by the way. It's really great. So you know, there's already an incredible ecosystem around software, especially in open source. And so one of the things that I like to think about is what does open source do especially well, and where might we be able to kind of apply some of those conventions that exist in open source in academia? The first thing I think open source does well and better than kind of scholarly communications is authorship. It explicitly recognizes the fact that authorship is not a static property. And so if I go and look at a project like scikit-learn, if I go to GitHub and look at that, then I can see how many contributors there are to this piece of software. And that's this kind of roll up here is essentially coming from a command called git shortlog. So this is a command you can run, and it will show you in the left-hand column here is the number of commits that this person, the number of changes that this person has contributed to this piece of software. And it's ordered by the number of commits here. So here's a kind of a UI in GitHub that kind of shows that. So we can see the project over time. You can see the kind of timeline of all the commits, and we can see the contributors, and we can even, you know, put a window on that period and see who the biggest contributors are over a specific area of time. But there's a kind of a recognition here that authorship is not a static property of software. The other thing I think that open source does well is it's really good on providing metrics, whatever metrics you like, and verification of kind of quality of work. So this is a website for the Python Package Index, which is a place where you can register and download Python tools. And you can see here the number of downloads that the scikit-learn package is getting. I think this is a month. I actually can't remember what the window here is, but you can see the number of people downloading it. And you can see there's these conventions. Some of you who use GitHub a lot will have seen these everywhere. These badges at the top here, the green and blue things, are all linking either to services. So you can see there's showing the sort of version services that provide some kind of understanding of either community metrics around this, or links out to tools like Coveralls here, which is a piece of infrastructure that's basically running all the automated tests for this piece of software. Here's another one here called Travis, where they're doing a got these automated tests that are verifying the function of the software and doing automated builds, and that's very visible in all of the project views. The other thing that I think software does really well is it expresses its dependencies. Mature languages these days, or especially the newer ones, are talking have very good mechanisms for expressing the dependencies. What does your piece of software depend on? And so there are projects like libraries.io, so this is a website that basically applies the PageRank algorithm to a piece of software and looks at what other pieces of software are making use of this. Again, I'm using scikit-learn and all these examples here, but it's basically building a rank and showing there are 2,000 pieces of software, open source pieces of software, that are making use, have expressed scikit-learn as a dependency, and so you can kind of go through all of those. And so, sorry, go ahead.
Can you go back?
Mm-hmm.
When you say here the 2,000 repositories, how do you find them?
So these are crawled from any open source project. So these are, I think, come from GitLab, SourceForge, and GitHub.
Okay.
So the people who built libraries.io crawl those websites.
With Google?
No, using the APIs that those platforms provide, generally. Yeah. And so here's an example. This is not scikit-learn now, but in Ruby, certainly, this is sort of what an expression of these dependencies looks like. You basically write out the names and the versions of the piece of software that you're depending on. So, one of the things I'm kind of interested in is, what if we try to steal or use some of these ideas that open source have and apply them to academia? And so one of the things that I want to introduce to this audience is this, what if we try to build a better academic credit model? And so what I mean by that is going beyond a sort of a paper-centric H index. And so there's a few reasons this is hard. One, it's an ecosystem challenge. It's not something that's at the whim of any individual researcher to fix. It's also hard because the infrastructure that we rely upon is generally not owned and directed by us. I like to use this term, sort of benevolent indexes. Lots of research fields don't have those. So this is probably pretty hard. I also don't know if you all know about how much money there is involved in some of these tools. Some of the tools that we rely upon, I think this is Web of Science, which is a thing that assigns H indexes for lots of people, was purchased for $3.5 billion. That's a lot of money to, I think, everybody. And this is, this is a very, very profitable area of the scholarly infrastructure that we all rely upon, and it's generally owned by venture capital firms who like thinking about profits and less about innovation, I think. So, I think one of the things that I'm motivated for us to think about is moving beyond just being able to cite papers, being able to cite other things that form scholarly outputs that we think are important. So that's data sets, software, whatever you can think about. So so here's an idea. This is an idea that came from a guy called Dan Katz, and he's at NCSA in Illinois. And one example of a potential fix here is an idea that he came up with called transitive credit, which I want to just spend a minute talking about. So imagine I have a paper. I wrote it, and I want to. I give every paper has a unit of credit. I have a unit of credit that I can apply. So I want the author to think about citing everything that they used to produce this piece of research. So, of course, because it's a paper by me, I cite myself probably quite a lot. I might cite some important related work in the field. And then I also want to cite maybe the mission, maybe the data sets that I made use of. I'm a cosmologist, so I'm thinking about WMAP and Planck. And so I'm applying some of my citation credit to these projects. Maybe these are still papers, but maybe they're also data releases or something else. Then I actually made really heavy use of some community software. So I want to, these would now be software citations, so I'm going to cite those. I also love scikit-learn, so I'm going to cite those. And then I'm going to figure out some way to apply some weighting there. So I said I have a unit of credit that I'm going to apply. And so here's how I choose to apply it. But then, of course, if you have something like a credit map like that, then you can also think about how would AstroPy, what would it be citing? And of course, it's heavily influenced by this paper by White, and it also makes use of NumPy and SciPy. And you can imagine this kind of building this graph of citation credit. So the idea here being that this becomes a transitive property of any individual publication here. You can go further and build this credit graph that includes all the constituent parts of research. So this is hard. It's just an idea. That's why it's just in a paper. There's no product or tool. It's just a fun idea that we threw around. And I think it's hard for many reasons that I've talked about. It's hard because we don't have control, and it's hard because the metrics that we rely upon are one-dimensional. Going further than that is a challenge, both in technically and in kind of how people think about giving credit and citing others. So the last one I want to leave you with is things that we can do now, things that we can do that are kind of fixes for elevating the role of software today. And so these are individual actions primarily. And so one is, simply ask authors to include software when you're reviewing a paper. So if somebody has, in the position of reviewing a submission, did you make use of software when you were doing this work? If so, what are those pieces of software? Many of the pieces of software that we use to do research are being written by academics who would benefit from that citation to their work. If you're in the fortunate position of sitting on a tenure review committee, think about including contributions that are just outside of purely paper-based submissions. So we are very lucky at Space Telescope. We employ a significant fraction of all of the people who produce this piece of software called AstroPy. These are astronomers writing software for themselves and for the community. That is an understood contribution to academia. If you didn't understand anything I talked about today, maybe take a course or send your student on one to learn more about what it looks like to publish software in an effective way and following best practices. And of course, I can say this now that I don't work at GitHub anymore. Share your software on GitHub, or somewhere where people can find it. And so, in truth, I think there's a whole bunch of things that we can do to elevate the role of software in academia, and some of them are in our control, and some of them probably aren't for a long time. So I'll stop there. Thanks. Yes. Sorry. I was just realized I just ditched my, yep.
The individual actions.
Yep.
Yep. Wouldn't be a good idea to offer five things that I would like you to point out about the software. Number one, the name. Mm-hmm. Number two, the license. Number three, something like that. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Perhaps it becomes the Smith's 5 points about how to code software. But sometimes a simple thing, a simple guideline like that, mm-hmm, helps a lot.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that I've certainly noticed is that if you look at journals or funders, often policy is ahead of like community practice. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking recently to AAAS journals that are, have AppJ and some of the other high-profile journals in astronomy and astrophysics, and just encouraging them to update their reviewer guidelines. Literally just say, like, here, just add these three things, and then just getting it into people's mind share. It's some of it's just about how to find them. Yep.
This is a big question, so feel free to ditch it. But what motivates people to put this massive amount of time into open source software? And this is kind of getting at what Jess is saying about alternative incentives. Mm-hmm. Why do these people do this?
I think open source has a different set of sort of... I think people are doing it in a large part because it's good for them and their mode. I mean, There's research on why people contribute to open source or release open source software. One of the answers that I like, but I don't think is as prominent, is people have a problem they want to solve, and then they've made use of lots of open source software, so they think, well, I'll just... How they think about the technology and they think about, well, I'll just do what I've seen other people do and release that software too. There's a pretty large thought that a lot of people are releasing software because they know that that's a good way to build a career, not in academia necessarily, but it's an understood, you know, there's this idea that your GitHub profile is in some way your resume, certainly in technology sector. Right, right, but not in academia, but outside of that. So having you know, high profile projects that people use my stuff, it's good. You know, it's building reputation. And I think for me, the challenge I see is that I think we understand, I think those norms exist in open source. I think what I'm, I guess, hoping we can do is have people who are bridging those two worlds. So I would argue that the people who write the best software, certainly in the most specialist kind, need to be very close to the research. In fact, probably need to be practicing researchers who then also have an understanding of open source and are motivated to, you know, release software for their peers.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, play devil's advocate a little bit, and maybe this is part of what Jess was saying, is do we need to have the same incentive, even if they're sort of halfway in the academic world, mm-hmm. but they're benefiting in some sense from writing the software?
Oh, well, I mean, but that work is generally not considered part of their day job. Right. So your job as a research fellow is to produce research, right? And so if you then have a short career as a research fellow because you spend half of your time writing software, then I would say that it's not work.
So you're talking primarily about people who are doing both.
I would say so. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think, I mean, just to be clear, I think there are, at a given scale, I mean, we have, there are 700 people at Space Telescope. 300 of those are permanent jobs, and they're just regular jobs. People are employed as engineers. But there are 20 astronomers who are, you know, on a tenure track, going through a tenure track process, who are both producing research output and writing software. And we hired them because of that. And I think, you know, if you get big enough, you can think about creating career paths that are, well, you can insulate people, but I think you do have to do that. You have to basically say, oh, well, it's understood that this person's providing value, but it's not understood in a way that I could then go and apply at a job somewhere else where. It's understood within your institution or within the scientific project that you're in. And so I genuinely believe that the, you know, if people are using your work, this is why software citation, I think, matters, because then I think it's very easy for people to see the impact that your work is having on the field, both through software and through, you know, novel research.
Think about a scientist producing a piece of research which has some flaws that the scientist would work on top of that. You can create mistakes in a chain, right? That would be unforgivable. Well, that scientist is writing software which is not, let's say, at the best standards. That software, sooner or later, and the faster we scale and the more high-performance computing we need to deal with a huge amount of data, it will create a chaos in 1, 2, 3 years, or how it progress. So to me, it's surprising the dichotomy between the rigor that you put in science and the lack of interest that put into the tools that make that science possible. So, I mean, I still believe that your presentation is totally on point, but still weak. You should still say, hey, this is outrageous. Mm-hmm. Software is...
I'm British, I don't, I think.
So I use software at all different levels. Mm-hmm. I might have stuff that we wrote, scripts that we wrote, mm-hmm. More complicated software tools that somebody wrote and maybe published a paper about that we easily can cite, software packages that we buy for big bucks, like microarray analysis software that costs $1,000, it's called GeneScreen, and then there's the kind of software that's so important. I'm thinking GenBanks, the BLAST software, all the software that's online through NCBI that we use for DNA analysis. And what criteria should we use to decide this software deserves to be cited. This we just put in our methods. Oh, we use the GenBank package,
yeah,
and we don't cite it.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I mean, should we cite Linus Torvalds? Should we cite the Linux kernel as an example? Or should we cite Microsoft Excel, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, methods, I think that's, I mean, I would say if, this is not a good answer to your question, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think if we believe that somebody's career is going to benefit from that citation, then we should cite it. But that requires an understanding of the origin of the software, and so that's why it's flawed. But, you know, it is the, taking AstroPy as an example, they are, you know, it's a community-run project. There's a couple of hundred astronomers that have worked on that piece of software. It's understood that it's individual astronomers working on that software. There's growing sort of understanding that you should cite AstroPy as a package. And people don't also then think, oh, I should probably cite NumPy, which is also written by people in research positions. They don't even think about that, right? And so that's a, you know, it's just what you have mind share in. So I don't have a good answer for you other than if you know where it's coming from, maybe that will help you understand.
So I take your point about software being an intellectual contribution.
Mm-hmm.
Let me bracket that for a second, because it's really important for me to have a thought about it. As a faculty member, there, it seems like there are alternate ways to incentivize or encourage people to write software. And the obvious one is getting teaching release,
mm-hmm.
so that you teach for your classes with the understanding that you'll be leading a project or contributing in a serious
mm-hmm.
way.
But you have to have become faculty to get that time.
Yes. I've noted. And so there is a problem. In order to get that faculty position, you have to build a reputation in the standard way.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, there's another possibility. A friend of mine had a postdoctoral position at Columbia, which was in part a teaching postdoc.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if another mechanism that we could have is a software postdoc, which would presumably be pretty fundable by the NSF.
Yeah, right. So actually one of the things, so in every 10 years, the astronomy community, well, physics has this, is it the P5 or something, the decadal process? So the decadal in astronomy and astrophysics is coming up in the next couple of years. This is one of the things that I think we're going to write about, which is if you just made, don't ask for more money, there's no more money, but if you just ask, say that if you have these fellowship positions or these that, where you can apply for dedicated funding, you know, there are Hubble fellowships, for example, you know, allowing for there to be Hubble fellowships that have kind of a dual role, both academic contribution and research and software. I mean, part of it is just raising the prestige of the activity, and awarding grants is a pretty good way to raise prestige, because people are like, oh, you got money for that. Some signaling of some kind.
There is, I mean, on the AstroPI, I mean, this is a prestige question. What I've noticed is that senior faculty who have very strong intellectual reputations
mm-hmm.
are starting to say this is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And even that is takes us a long way towards recognizing AstroPy as not just, you know, building an interface, but something really cool.
Yep.
Great, thank you.
Oh, I had one more question in the back, sorry. Yeah.
So yeah, I guess the question is what's the end goal of this exercise, right? Because it seems like within, let's say, GitHub, you already have this wonderful metric, right, and many different ways to parse the contributions. So it seems like, so I guess the key word here is prestige, but again, prestige in itself, I don't really know what it means. So if the goal is to, let's say, to put somebody on the tenure track, let's say somebody's a postdoc and their contributions, you want to recognize so that that person will be competitive, let's say, for the academic jobs. That's a specific goal, right? But again, probably to put somebody on the faculty, you care about things in addition to whether the person's writing good software or not. You also care whether they can be a good researcher, whether they can sort of write up their results and so on. So what do you really see as the goal of this exercise?
I mean, ultimately, I think I would like for people who are writing high quality software, research software, to have career tracks in academia. So that's my goal, and I think that's what we need to solve. Now, whether that's faculty or whether that's, I mean, there are lots of different models. In the UK, for example, there's growing use of this term called research software engineer. So what you do is you sort of centralize this specialism within a university, and you say, here is a group of people who are well-versed in writing software for to solve research problems, but they're in effectively a business unit within the university, and then you write them in, you ask for, you contract them when you have a grant or when you have a project. And so, you know, there's a bunch of different models, I think, but, you know, right now, if I want to solve problems, if I like solving problems, research problems, and I get too good and too interested in writing software and forget to write papers, then that's a one-way ticket out of academia right now, I think. You know,
so
that's not necessarily what we want.
Right, but I mean, still the implications of this, if you want to be on faculty, I mean, by academic job, I understand something like a so you do teaching, you do some research. So if you're so much into writing software, I mean, it's not so clear whether that's going to transfer well into, let's say, academic position in the sense of somebody, you know, spending, I don't know, 60 or 80% of their time educating people, right? So, and writing papers sort of goes part way, right? Because it sort of at least shows that you can express what you're thinking fairly. Clearly.
I would say that well-written software is an expression of thought as well.
Sure. I mean, it is, but it's kind of like, and look, so there are software engineers, I guess, so people who came from industry that work in engineering departments, right? And you go to MIT, I guess there are a bunch of people who came from industry and back to education, to engineering.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like this group of people doesn't exist, but I guess you're advocating something slightly different. So that, let's say the physics department or in the astronomy department, there will be people who are sort of, just like there are people who are instrument scientists,
mm-hmm.
There will be people who are doing software.
Yeah, I mean, that a similar model to the sort of understanding the conventions we have in instrument science would be a model we could look at as well. That's right.
Good, thank you.
Thanks.